Welcome to the Wednesday Conversation. I'm Mike Kresnick, and I'm here with Pastor Bob Thune and Pastor Dusty White and Chris Hemmelman of Coram Deo Church. Every Wednesday, we sit down to talk about how the gospel of Jesus Christ connects to the questions and issues of everyday life. And today, we're talking about the new political correctness.
What does that mean, Bob Thune?
This conversation is triggered by a cover story in The Atlantic, September 2015, called Better Watch What You Say, How the New Political Correctness is Ruining Education. It's a fascinating article. It's a long article. You can find it online. The Atlantic posts their stuff online for free. The title of the article, once you open the magazine, is called The Coddling of the American Mind. So the contours of the article are this. On campuses, on college campuses, there's this strong movement right now toward not saying or doing anything that anyone could potentially find offensive. And it's getting sort of ridiculous. And the authors of this article are basically saying, these are not Christian writers, they're just people observing this and saying, this is going to lead to poorer mental health among the students that are immersed in this. If this is where things keep going, it's not going to lead to greater and more healthy and vibrant lives, but actually to worse lives. And they make some interesting points. So here's a couple. Let us give you the glossary of terms you're going to need for this conversation. Number one, microaggression. Chris, what is a microaggression?
A microaggression is a small action or word choice that seems on their face to have no malicious intent, but thought of as kind of violence nonetheless.
Perfect.
Give me an example, Chris.
Kind of violence?
So an example is, at least what this article cites, is asking an Asian American or Latino American, where were you born? Because this implies that he or she is not a real American.
I'm immediately offended.
It's pretty offensive.
Well, you're not even Asian.
Because
I'm offended
Hispanic.
For them.
Or asking an Asian American, are you good at math?
Or you're supposed to be good at math, it says.
Yeah, those are examples of what are now called microaggressions. So, in other words, the intent might not be to be aggressive, but these are microaggressions. They are offensive. Here's another glossary term from the article, emotional reasoning. Emotional reasoning is assuming that your negative emotions necessarily reflect the way things really are. I feel it, therefore it must be true. And these authors are saying emotional reasoning dominates many campus debates and discussions. A claim that here's the really interesting thing right here that starts to make this really dangerous. A claim that someone's words are offensive is not just an expression of one's own subjective feeling of offendedness. It is rather a public charge that the speaker has done something objectively wrong and a demand that the speaker apologize or be punished by some authority for committing an offense. So basically the way this goes is, you offended me, Chris, therefore you've done something objectively wrong, you need to apologize or be punished. So here's an example. Last fall, a student at the University of Michigan wrote a satirical column for a student newspaper poking fun at the campus tendency to perceive microaggressions in just about anything. So a guy just doing good satire, basically saying, let's make fun of how everything's a microaggression these days. The editors of the newspaper said that the way he had satirically mocked the experiences of fellow contributors created a conflict of interest, and so they fired him. Like, you can't even write satire about microaggression without it being perceived as microaggressive.
In a university paper.
Here's another one, 2008. At the Indiana University, Purdue University at Indianapolis.
IUPUI.
Wow.
A student was found guilty of racial harassment for reading a book titled Notre Dame versus the Klan. The book honored student opposition to the Ku Klux Klan when it marched on Notre Dame in 1924. Nonetheless, the picture of a Klan rally on the book's cover offended at least one of the student's coworkers, and that was enough for a guilty finding by the university's affirmative action office.
Hmm. Wow.
Even when you're against racism, you're racist.
Here's another one. Bergen Community College in New Jersey suspended Francis Schmidt, a professor, after he posted a picture of his daughter on his Google account showing her wearing a t-shirt that read, I will take what is mine with fire and blood. I'm sure she just got up and put on a shirt. The campus administrators perceived that as a threat because about 2 months earlier, Schmidt had filed a grievance after being passed over for a sabbatical. And so a Bergen security official present at a meeting between administrators and Schmidt thought the word fire could refer to AK-47s. So they basically said, you posting this photo of your daughter is like a subliminal way of saying that you're threatening us.
Man, some deep insecurity going on.
So the point here is there's a few angles that we want to take this. One is just to say this is going to make it all the more interesting for Christians in the years to come, especially those engaged in college and community college work. Because this is more and more becoming the culture of campus. And I think ultimately the gospel has some things to say here. I think there's ways in which we can be uniquely and distinctly helpful in this conversation. The interesting thing about this article is the two authors who wrote it are making the case that this whole thing, this whole emphasis on microaggression and emotional disturbance and all of that is creating poor mental health because it acts as though things are real when they really aren't real, and that one of the most famous counseling techniques that's been used for years in psychotherapy is cognitive behavioral therapy, which is basically admitting to yourself what I perceive to be true isn't necessarily true. And so it's just like, it's basically what we would say, like speaking the truth to yourself, like believing what is true. That's the sort of the baseline of cognitive behavioral therapy. And they're saying, if we would teach students to do this, that would help them not perceive microaggressions when someone's writing a satirical column in the student newspaper.
I wonder, kind of thinking through, like what is it that is giving fuel to this phenomenon on college campuses? What is being gained by claiming I've been offended by sort of accusing others of microaggression? Are there some deep identity issues in play here, where me being harassed or me being the victim of a microaggression gives me some sort of leverage within my sort of social circle or within the campus, or does it give me some sort of status as someone who has been harassed and been a victim of whatever type of aggression? And so even in that, like what is it that people are building their identity on, and why is that so gratifying that they would take on the identity of victim above any other identity?
That's a provocative question.
Wow. Great question.
I think there's definitely some identity connections here. And it does seem that just the sort of the victim mentality is pretty foundational to this. If I can perceive anything you might say, whether you intend it to be hurtful or not, as offensive, and that gives me the right to objectively say that you've wronged me, that's the sort of the definition of a victim mentality, right? Whatever you've done, whether you meant to or not, has victimized me.
And then I can stay in that victim identity, which makes me better than you, right?
It's interesting that I think there's probably, too, here, not just an identity component, but just a virtue component. In other words, if you think about the nature of how we've sort of the way our culture has come, we rather than encouraging people to resolve conflict, have healthy debate, you know, fight it out with the bully on the playground, those kind of things, you know, it's sort of like we've gone to this hyper emotive extreme where we really want to honor people's emotions, but it's almost that we've gone so far in that direction that we've not formed children, especially, with the capacity to like deal with, you know, being ridiculed or, you know, kids at school not liking them, like that's not okay anymore. Where in the past, you know, sort of like in our parents and grandparents' generations, that was just sort of like part of growing up. Like, yeah, there's going to be some kids at school who are mean to you, and you're going to have to either,
stones,
you know, you're going to have to learn to fight them or learn to grow through that. So it's interesting. There's an identity component, and I think there's also sort of a formation component here of we've coddled people's emotions for so long, that now they're now to violate anyone's emotions or make them feel anything that's unpleasant equals an offense.
Well, and we obviously live in a culture where we're celebrating diversity, so therefore everybody has their own thing.
Their own micro niche.
Yeah, you cannot offend me because, you know, I can sue you now.
And not to minimize like those who have legitimately been victimized by aggression, but there is a sense where that walking around with that identity, this victim identity, I think there's a sense where that's got to be incredibly burdensome and tiring, because you have to consistently generate this sense of moral outrage and that I have been victimized and I have been wronged. And at some point that has just got to be an incredibly heavy burden. And so this is where I think we get into what the gospel frees us from. There's some significant heart issues and freedom issues that the gospel is going to confront for those that sort of embraced this identity of victim.
Let's go further in that, because that's an important wrinkle right there. How does the gospel start to unlock and free us from the identity of victim?
I think the first thing that the gospel will tell us is, yes, there is sin, and yes, you've been sinned against. And so it will validate the reality of being sinned against. Now, this doesn't necessarily mean that every time you have been have experienced microaggression, that is valid and legitimate, but it does have the category, it does open up the reality that we can acknowledge we have been sinned against. And so I think that's an important starting place of, yeah, there's sin in this world, and you will be sinned against, and that sin can really hurt. So there is an empathy piece, but I think what the good news of the gospel is that there is both forgiveness for you personally, and there is freedom, because the shame and even the pain that comes with being sinned against, Christ can set you free from that, because he offers you an even greater identity. And so for those who have been legitimately hurt and this identity of victim is, it's easy for them to sort of embrace that and hold on to that. Jesus is saying, hey, give me that pain, give me that hurt, because my sacrifice, my victory over sin frees you from having to identify with that.
That's good news.
Preach, preacher.
I'll take another angle that might even be somewhat provocative to some listeners who will perceive this as a microaggression, even though it's not. but I think in some sense this is a consequence of feminism, especially on the college campus. Because one of the things you notice, like one of the classic differences between men and women, is little boys are taught, you know, don't cry, suck it up, you're fine. Now, that can go in really unhealthy directions when guys get emotionally shut down. But generally, in sort of the stereotypical old, you know, traditional cultures, women, it's more okay and more accepted for women to show emotion, to express feeling and those kinds of things. And little boys aren't supposed to do that as much. Now, those differences are okay and good, and we shouldn't polarize them, and we shouldn't say, you know, boys don't feel feelings, girls do, or it's not okay for boys to show emotion, it is okay for girls to show emotion. I think there's ways that those stereotypes can become harmful and hazardous. But in general, I think what's happened is, God created us different. God created us male and female. There are differences emotionally and physiologically and psychologically between men and women. And the sort of emphasis on feminism, especially in sort of popular academia, right? The feminist worldview has really defined most of academia for the last 20 or 30 years. And part of what that has created is a devaluing of sort of masculine virtues. And there are even like Camille Paglia, who's a feminist lesbian intellectual, would say, we're destroying little boys' ability to grow up and be masculine because we're trying to make them make them display feminine virtues instead of masculine ones. And so there are, you know, feminists who say this exact same thing that I'm saying. But I think that part of this this sort of like hypersensitivity toward anything that could be perceived as offensive, it seems to me, is an example of a lessening of the sort of toughness, the virtue of toughness, the virtue of tenacity, the virtue of, you know, get back up after the bully hits you and go, you know, go to class. I mean, you know, that now, again, it's not that you should take beatings from bullies every day of your life. Like there might be a time to for your parents to step in, or for someone to call that aggression, which it is. But it's interesting to me that there does seem to be here a connection to the push toward feminism and the flattening of distinctions between genders, so that the only thing that we have now is offense and offenders, right? We don't have sort of a full spectrum of emotional and physiological and psychological range, the fullness of human experience, and the ability to have balance here and fullness.
So would you say the things that the article in The Atlantic is pointing to affects men more than it affects women?
No, not necessarily. I just think it's funny. Like, anytime I read an article like this, I'm like, what would my grandfather say about this? Like, mm-hmm. I think he would just read this and go, this is just dumb. Like, mm-hmm. really? Mm-hmm. You can't, you know, satire means somebody's offending you. Mm-hmm. That's dumb. You know, like, you need to suck it up. Like, this is where there's wisdom in traditional culture and even in traditional stereotypes. Stereotypes are not always bad. Stereotypes sometimes exist because they allow us to pass on cultural frameworks that are essential to human flourishing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to sort of start a Facebook group because your professor used a word in class that, you know, reminded you of a bad experience you had when you were five. Like, mm-hmm. I think our fathers and grandfathers would look at that and go, you're just being a baby. Stop it. Mm-hmm. You know? So that's what I'm trying to say here, is that there's a devaluing of sort of the traditional masculine wisdom, mm-hmm. in a way that I think opens the door for, and especially the interesting thing of connection to identity, Chris, is that feminism, I don't want to, not all aspects of feminism have been bad, but the sort of more radical elements of the feminist movement have very much been about, identity politics, right? It's been very much about, we are identifying as a persecuted minority that has always lived in a patriarchal world. And so the only way to write that is not just to point that out and say, this is true, but to counterbalance that by now, pressing for sort of all the way, acknowledging all the ways we've been victimized, right? Essentially. And so again, there are true and good elements that feminism has brought to the radar, to the table. But the more hyper elements of feminism, I think, have played right into that sort of identity piece that that everybody now has to be identified with an oppressed subgroup, and everybody has to, you know, demand that everybody else in the world sort of accommodate to their preferences and desires and the ways that they've been despised or not honored.
Yeah, and even if you don't accommodate or share my view, you at least can't offend me. You at least can't have a stand that says no to what I believe.
I think what that example of satire shows also, a sad piece of this, is this hyper-victimization mentality. You lose the sense of humor, and even important humor. I mean, satire plays an important function where if we can't just laugh at ourselves and kind of poke fun, even if we sort of admit, yeah, that's a weakness of mine, and you can't laugh at that, then that tightens you up and sort of pushes you inside yourself in such a way that again is restrictive and really promotes an internal sickness. And so I think one of the signs that, you know, this victimization mentality has probably overtaken you is you can't laugh at yourself. You can't have fun. You can't sort of acknowledge where you have mistakes or maybe even laugh at where people have sort of said things that are ridiculous. Like, oh man, yeah, that was kind of a racist comment, but hi, you know, whatever. And so I think even making those, being able to make the distinctions between sort of, you know, real offense and then where we should just be laughing at ourselves and kind of acknowledging that we're weak, we're frail, we're human, and we make mistakes, we just lose that. And it's sad. And so I think, again, going back to where the gospel can free us to look at our weakness and sometimes just laugh at the fact we're human.
Anyway, there's an important connection there to formation again, because part of what I realize is, man, people need freedom to make mistakes, right? Like,
yeah.
The only way you learn not to be a racist is by accidentally being one and having someone who loves you enough to say, hey man, do you realize that's do you realize what that's connected to? Do you realize how that feels to, like, you know, like, if my kids grew up in a world where they can't ever make a mistake like that, it frees them from actually growing and becoming the kinds of human beings that the gospel turns them into, right? And so now, instead of the freedom to repent, acknowledge, forgive, extend grace, we now have a culture where any kind of offense is immediately, you're now an offender and you're a bad person and you need to be labeled and stigmatized and penalized. And that's just a culture where there's no freedom. That's a very law-driven, legalistic world to grow up in. And man, if I had had to learn everything I've learned in life by never making a mistake, I don't know that I'd be a very well-rounded person.
The thing that keeps coming to mind is just fearful pride, or even fear of man. Because if you're just consistently paralyzed by others' opinions and thoughts, and you're hesitant to share your opinions or your thoughts, or you haven't fought for anything in your life, or you have to be overly sensitive to everybody else, then I think, you know, this all just ties into that. And so I think gospel implications here, obviously fearful pride, and you will have to have confidence, and you actually will have to be critical of other people at certain times, just according to your Bible. So I think if you struggle with fearful pride or fear of man, I think that's where this is going to really get you, more than it might get others. So that's what comes to mind as I'm thinking about gospel implications here.
I think too, the thing that keeps coming to my mind as well is, Bob, you said earlier that this idea has kind of formed in us, a right to not be offended. And, when I think of Philippians 2, I think it is where Christ, when he came incarnate, did not see being God as something to be grasped. And in that identity piece where we feel like we can't be offended, there's a piece of us that we're above that, like we're God almost, like we're not affected by those things. And if somebody does that towards us, then like, whoa, you've committed the ultimate sin. And when I think about Christ, as we talked about the gospel, him bearing all of that shame and all of those offenses, looking at him take on that, he ultimately didn't deserve that. He had the right to not have those things put on him, but he took them.
Yeah. And so you're connecting an interesting piece that really this is all a manifestation of idolatry, because what it says is self is God, and any offense against self is an objectively morally wrong action, versus when the gospel rightly orients us to God and we come under the authority of God, the lordship of Christ, we realize, well, that's what gives me the freedom to laugh at myself, because self is no longer the highest authority. Self is no longer something that can't be violated and laughed at and offended. Now.
And it gives you it frees you to be like, man, that does offend me, but like, I forgive you.
Right.
And I'm not going to like hold that against you.
Right. Whereas if I'm God, I don't have, because again, there's no intercession apart from the work of Christ, right? If I am God, because I don't have an atoning sacrifice to pay for your sin, the only thing I can do then is punish you for your sin.
Yeah, I'm going
to
make you pay. Yeah.
Well, I hope this podcast, number one, gives you some insight into some of the dynamics that are at play in the broader culture and helps you be wiser and more thoughtful in how we engage those things. And two, hope that as the gospel continues to change and transform you, you become also more capable of laughing at yourself, more capable of grounding your identity in Christ, and more capable of forgiving and extending grace toward others. So, In the final estimation, the church certainly should be a place where none of these things are at play, where there's a lot of grace for us to make mistakes, learn to love each other, and grow in Christlikeness.
We'll post the link to this article from The Atlantic online, and as you read it and engage it, feel free to join in the conversation by tweeting us at Cormdale Omaha, and we'll talk to you again next Wednesday on the Wednesday Conversation.